You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Indeed Sponsored Jobs. If you're looking to make a big signing this spring, Indeed is all you need, because Indeed Sponsored Jobs can help your job ad stand out from the crowd so you can hire the best quality candidates who can give you the results you need. Sponsored Jobs boosts your post so that you attract the best quality candidates and reach the right people who have all the skills and experience that you need. It makes a big difference too, because according to Indeed's data, Sponsored Jobs posted directly on Indeed are 90% more likely to report a hire than non-sponsored jobs. And that's because you reach a much wider pool of top quality candidates. So join the 1.6 million companies that sponsor their jobs with Indeed. Spend more time interviewing candidates who tick all of your boxes. There's less stress, less time spent on the hiring process, and better results with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners to the Cycling Podcast will get a £100 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves. Just go to indeed.com/cycle. That's indeed.com/cycle. And you'll be supporting our show too by saying that you heard about Indeed on the Cycling Podcast. So indeed.com/cycle. Terms and conditions apply. If you're hiring, do it the right way with Indeed. Now it's on with the show.
Hello, and joining you after a week in cycling when Jonas Vingegaard proved his pedigree as a past and maybe future Tour de France winner and also a dungaree present-day cycling fashion influencer. My name is Daniel Freeman. I'm the host of this episode of the Cycling Podcast, in which we'll review the action from Paris-Nice, aka the race, not quite to the snowbound alpine ski resort, and Tirreno Adriatico, aka the race to Italy's bleakest off-season seaside resort. And we'll also look forward to La Classicissima, aka Milano Sanremo, at the weekend. Joining me to do that with his bucket and spade and inflatable crocodile is Lionel Burney.
Hello, Daniel. I thought you were going to make a comment about dungarees or mankinis or Jonas Vingegaard's crimes against fashion.
That's coming. And also joining us in his ski goggles and salopettes, not dungarees, it's Rob Hatch.
Just channeling my inner Jensen Plowright.
Rob Hatch, who probably knows that actually there's no differentiation, no distinction made between the word for salopettes and bib shorts in Italian. So maybe that was what confused Jonas Vingegaard. But I wasn't as outraged as that crime against fashion.
Of course,
so the people.
The podcast contrarian.
Well, Lionel, you will know very well that we've seen sort of mock dungarees on cycling kits before. The Castorama kit in the 90s and the Big Mac kit much later than that. I think that was the early 2000s. It's something that may yet catch on again after last week. I know I was privy to a voice message sent to a good friend of ours. I'm not going to reveal anyone's identity here, by a storied, a venerable old Italian director sportif who was particularly outraged by what he'd seen from Vingegaard, what Vingegaard was wearing on that particular day, which proved decisive and proved a launch pad for his victory at Paris.
I mean, no exaggeration. And after last week's heated debate about Pogacar and whether his dominance is becoming boring, I mean, we've got to be in agreement here. This is literally the worst thing that's ever happened in professional cycling. Forget all of the doping scandals.
I think you're being a contrarian now. I think you probably thought deep down, I think you probably thought it was all right, but you're being a contrarian now.
Well, I did read that apparently Eduardo Affini and Victor Campenaerts were supposed to be able to ride alongside Vingegaard and pull either side of these custom-made bib tights to pull them off, Bucks Fizz style. Do you remember Bucks Fizz in the 80s? Probably too young, maybe. Where they whip the skirts off mid-song. A reference for all the kids, that one. You'll have to look it up on YouTube. I mean, it was an unusual sight, wasn't it? Vingegaard riding to victory with his bib tights outside his jacket. I mean, considering the grief I got once for wearing my socks outside my bib tights when I was riding the Milan-San Remo course a few years ago, I mean, you know, where does the tolerance begin here? There shouldn't be any. You know, cycling is an aesthetic sport. If this catches on, I'm out.
There was some good, there was one in particular, I think it was our friends at Velo, maybe Andy Hood or Jim Cotton did a compilation of crimes against cycling fashion in the wake of Vingegaard's last week, and that was enjoyable. Some notable ones from recent history. Mike Woods was it one leg warmer, wasn't it, in Liège-Bastogne-Liège? That was a notable one. But there have been many over the years. I was more sort of aghast, really, at how aghast other people were about the way Red Bull bore a Hansgrohe road that day. There was a lot of sort of hand-wringing. We'll get on to Paris-Nice in a bit, but there was a lot of hand-wringing about Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe having towed Vingegaard to the finish and ultimately, I suppose, victory. But to me, this was classic sort of Monday morning quarterbacking. I don't really see what the better alternative was. Dani Martinez was not going to beat Vingegaard anyway, and by doing that, they effectively took Martinez to second place. They earned him second place overall, which he was able to defend over subsequent stages, and they got themselves a lot of UCI points, which of course is our new obsession. That's all we talk about on this podcast, UCI points.
I mean, Red Bull should have done cycling a favour. They should have taken Vingegaard off course into a cafe and forced him to change his clothing so he dressed appropriately for winning a stage of Paris-Nice.
This feels like I'm being gaslit, Lionel. Here, I'm very suspicious of this position you've adopted here. Anyway, chaps, we must get on with things, but remaining with winter sports and skiing, one thing I did just want to mention before we do talk about Paris-Nice and Tirreno Adriatico is that a good friend of the podcast, Joe Dombrowski, who regular listeners will remember, is sort of pursuing a bit of a post-retirement side quest in a sport called Skimo, which featured in the Winter Olympics recently. But Joe, this year, and I think he was supposed to do it last year but had a broken leg, he competed in something, an event which is often described as the Tour de France of Skimo, ski mountaineering, and that is a race called the Pierre Monta. It's a four-day stage race, and he wasn't the only former pro cyclist taking part this year. Tony Paltzer, former Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe rider, who is no longer cycling with them this year, and he's gone back to his sort of first love of Skimo. He was also competing. It's a pairs event, so Tony Paltzer had a pair, Joe Dombrowski, and also Mike Woods, who is also pursuing a bit of a side quest in various other disciplines, including Skimo. Just to give you the results, none of the aforementioned former bike riders were able to win the Pierre Monta. It would have been a surprise if they had. Tony Pouts was fourth with his partner on GC. Joe, a very creditable 30th place on GC. Some excellent results in the uphill part of the Pierre Monta. And Mike Woods and Amund Grøndahl Jansen, who you'll probably remember, formerly of Green Edge, whatever they were called when he was riding for them, and Visma Lisa Bike as well, whatever they were called when he was riding for them. They were 113th. So some very creditable crossover performances there from Joe and some of the other chaps I've just mentioned. Another thing I just wanted to mention on a much more somber note, chaps. Again, UK listeners will probably be aware that over the weekend there was some very sad news in the UK domestic scene. Photographer, reporter, sort of fixture, stalwart of the UK domestic scene, Larry Hickmott, who covered that scene for very many years. Lionel, you, I'm sure, came across him. I came across him, although we don't do a lot of reporting on the domestic UK scene. He was part of the furniture, very much, and he passed away very sadly at the weekend. Larry, who hailed from Queensland, I believe, but for very many years was one of these people who, sort of from the outside, might have been seen as a kind of idiosyncratic figure, an eccentric figure. But why was he dedicating so much of his life to bike racing? But in doing so, he did that world a tremendous service, because it was a world that wasn't readily covered by many journalists, many photographers, and he will leave a big void. And as I say, someone who had leaves a real sort of legacy. If you go back through the archives, you'll be able to find interviews that Larry did with with generations of British riders who later went on to become very famous names, like Mark Cavendish, Geraint Thomas on the women's side, Kat Ferguson, and so on and so forth. So sad news that Larry Hickmott passed away at the weekend.
Yeah, just echo that, Daniel, because it was a tremendous service that Larry did for racing in the UK. Over 25 years covering all of the domestic racing scene, really the go-to guy when it came to finding out what was going on, and a pioneer in a lot of ways, because it was the kind of the dawn of the internet came along at the same time that the media, the print media, was changing quite significantly. And I was there at Cycling Weekly magazine at a time when they were really wrestling with how to embrace the internet without damaging their business model. And one of the things was to move away from covering what had become quite a sort of niche aspect of the sport, which was the domestic racing, which of course left a lot of readers with nowhere to go. And Larry saw that opportunity and realised that there was a very strong and passionate audience for the British domestic scene, and he covered it very well for a long time. So yeah, very sad news over the weekend.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast Team Car, the back of the pack, please.
This episode of the Cycling Podcast is brought to you by BICMO Cycle Insurance, because let's face it, things happen. Whether it's a crash landing, the heartbreak of a stolen bike, or the ultimate facepalm moment of reversing over your prized aero wheel, BICMO has you covered. Flexible policies that you can cancel anytime, 50% off extra bikes in your household, protection for your kit, race entries, and even damage while travelling to your next epic ride. They've thought of it all. And here's the thing, BICMO isn't some faceless insurance company. They're all bike riders too, with a shared mission to protect the world's riders and the places we ride. So when you insure with them, you're not just getting great coverage, you're joining a community that gets what it means to love cycling. So whether you're smashing sprints, grinding climbs, or just enjoying a Sunday spin, ride safe. BICMO's got your back. Protect your ride before it's too late. Head to BICMO.com to get covered. That's BICMO.com. Flexible policies. Cancel anytime. Terms apply. Check your policy docs.
Pepsi Prebiotic Cola, an original and cherry vanilla. That Pepsi taste you love, with no artificial sweeteners, only 30 calories, just 5 grams of sugar, and 3 grams of prebiotic fiber. That great Pepsi taste with even more to love. Pepsi Prebiotic Cola. Unbelievably Pepsi.
With Car Guru's Discover, you can skip the filters and describe what you're looking for in your own words. Simply type what you want, and Car Guru's Discover instantly surfaces real listings that match your exact needs. It's no wonder Car Guru's is the number one most visited car shopping site, according to SimilarWeb's estimated traffic data. Buy or sell your next car today with Car Guru's at CarGurus.com. Go to CarGurus.com to make sure your big deal is the best deal. That's CarGurus.com. CarGurus.com.
Well, chaps, as already mentioned, two major World Tour stage races took place last week. Rob, you and I last night, while we were watching football, we were talking yet again, and we were returning to my new obsession, UCI points, and we were wringing our hands about the disgraceful number of points available for stage winners at Pirelli, Santirino, Adriatico, as compared with other races that have happened and will happen this year. But, chaps, generally speaking, what I would say is that these were two absolutely barnstorming races, cracking races last week. There were some grumbles. I was listening to some French podcast yesterday, and there were some grumbles about Paris-Nice, the fact that it had been sort of decapitated again.
Is that because there wasn't a French winner?
Well, maybe
if Vauclav won, I think there might have been a different reaction.
Paul Sexas, who last week on one of the podcasts, they said that Remco Evenepoel had been made to feel like a Minitel when the internet appeared. By the appearance of Paul Sexas. Minitel was a bit, it's difficult to describe what Minitel is or was in France, but it's kind of like teletext, but a sort of personal version of teletext in France.
Could you buy all of this
anyway,
on it?
Anyway, maybe that's why they were so down on Paris-Nice, but they were also down on it, obviously, because we had the now traditional sort of truncation of the Saturday stage because of snow. The race was supposed to finish at altitude at Oran, and we had that pretty sort of funky Very short stage, 40-something kilometres, a bunch sprint at the foot of the sort of Southern Alps. So that was a bit janky, that was a bit funky. But otherwise, I thought both races highlighted the fact that you can and you do have great racing without necessarily going high up in the mountain, particularly at this time of year. And I thought particularly, and maybe we'll get onto this in a minute, Tirreno Adriatico sort of showed its big brother, the Giro d'Italia, the way it should be going, and it sort of ceased to go in the last few years. Not enough sort of puncher stages in the Giro d'Italia. We had a week of them in Tirreno, and we had some great racing as a result. But I also thought that was the case from day one with Paris-Nice. Rob, you were commentating on it. Just fill us in quickly, if you will, on what happened at Paris-Nice.
Well, we had the traditional, now traditional, in the last, what, decade and a bit, starting the Yvelines, just to the west of Paris, sort of outskirts region. And that opening stage has become one that anybody can win, classics riders or sprinters. This year it was more of a sprint. It was Luke Lamperti, the American, now moved to EF Education Easy Post. He took his first ever World Tour win on that day. And we had another first World Tour win the day after, Max Cantor. What about that? There was all the sort of rigmarole and problems at the little chicane going into Montargis that was negotiated pretty well a couple of years ago by Tudor, but this time it was XDS Astana. Tuesday, third stage. I'm already thinking it's a Wednesday, but it started on a Sunday. So Tuesday, the team time trial that was won by Ineos Grenadiers. First team time trial win for them for five long seasons since they did it at the Tour of Britain. That was a brilliant race from them. And a change in the yellow jersey, because Juan Ayuso of Lidl Trek just went into the yellow jersey. Then it was the day, wasn't it? The big day. The wind, the rain, pretty much biblical conditions. Incredible for us to sit in nice, warm living rooms or wherever we were and watch. Pretty horrible to be out on the bike. And the aforementioned crimes against fashion took place. Was it dungarees? Improvised dungarees? The improvised...
It was a sort of Will Smith, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air kind of look, wasn't it?
It was a Borat mankini. I mean, let's get it right.
Oh, the polar opposites of the debate, eh? Victor Campenaerts found himself right in the middle of that, and in true Victor Campenaerts style, with the brilliant accent that he's got, he was describing that he actually was unstitching a chamois the night before, just so that there wouldn't be a double chamois and his saddle height wouldn't change. So he actually personally adapted them, and that's why they were a bit loose on the top, because they'd started cutting them apart. So,
however heinous anyone, and you included, Lionel, thinks that crime against fashion was, it is nothing anywhere near as heinous as the crimes against Italian cuisine that Matteo Jorgensen has been committing recently.
No.
But anyway, maybe we'll talk about that in a minute.
I've got a bone to pick with him, actually. Anyway, let's carry on, because despite all of the fashion crimes, or not crimes, or little bits of eyebrow raising, it was a brilliantly raced day by mainly Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe, but also this Melissa bike, because with Eduardo Affini, they managed to get Jonas Vingegaard into the front split on a day where it split just after 3 kilometres of racing in the wind. But because Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe were pushing on and pushing on, there were some wet descents, and there was a big crash in that group at the front before they got to the final run into the last climb. The biggest victim of that big crash, I'm afraid, was Juan Ayuso, who crashed out in the yellow jersey. There was also a crash out for Brandon McNulty. A few others went as well. And it completely changed the race, because Vingegaard suddenly found himself as a bit of a VIP guest in a big Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe limousine that was travelling rather fast, pushed on by the Van Dijker brothers and Nico Dentz. They went to the intermediate sprint. Dani Martinez was beaten there by Jonas Vingegaard, already bonus seconds for Vingegaard. They got to the final kilometre of the race. There was one attack, one moment, one click of a finger, and Vingegaard was gone. That was it. That was all it needed. And he put about 50 seconds on the road into Dani Martinez in that last kilometre. So the race had a clear leader by then. The day after, Vingegaard then repeated the feat. He went with 20 kilometres to go. He put 2 minutes, 2 seconds into his closest rival on the day, who was Valentin Paris-Peintre, who, by the way, already at the GC this time, was just looking for stage wins. The biggest winning margin for a long, long time in a Paris-Nice stage. Then we saw Harald Tejada take another first World Tour win, a second stage win of the week for XDS Astana. Dorian Godon won that rather strange stage that you briefly alluded to, Daniel, which was an uphill ride that didn't look great, did it? But Ineos, they did the job on the day and they did what they had to do, and it was a very well-won stage again. First Bahini stage win for the now French champion. And Lenny Martinez on the final day winning just down the road from where he's from in Cannes. He won in Nice just outside of the football stadium, not the Promenade des Anglais traditional finish because the elections were on, there weren't enough police, they weren't allowed into town. All sorts was going on there, so they weren't allowed to do the same final stage. So Paris-Nice without Col d'Aise and without the Promenade des Anglais looked a little strange, but it was still nonetheless a really good finish in circuit, well won by Martinez, who went away with Jonas Vingegaard inside the last 15 kilometres or so on the last climb. They got around 30 seconds to 40 seconds. They took it to a two-up sprint, and Lenny Martinez repeated the feat from last year. He won a stage at Paris-Nice, but Jonas Vingegaard won Paris-Nice altogether by the biggest winning margin since the 1930s, Daniel.
Lenny Martinez looking as cunning as a fox with a degree in cunning from the Sorbonne, the way he rode those final kilometres on that last day. Very smart, I thought, the way he dealt with that situation and rode with Jonas Vingegaard only to rob him in the sprint. Chaps, I just wanted to, I almost paused you there, Rob, in that description, because I had my little mini rant earlier about other people ranting about Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe on that stage, the stage where the wind and rain wreaked havoc. But what did you chaps think of that? Because it was the key moment of the race, wasn't it? It was the key sort of hour of the race.
Well, it was. I mean, Jonas Vingegaard found himself in the Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe club sandwich. Club sandwich has three slices of bread, doesn't it? And Vingegaard proved himself to be both the chicken and bacon, I suppose, because he won the stage and set up the overall. I mean, Dani Martinez was obviously, you know, riding for a high overall position and ended up second overall, a distant second overall, 4:23. And I mean, the time gaps in the top 10 and beyond look like a Tour de France from the sort of 1990s, don't they? Riders at 6, 9, 10, 11 minutes. So it was a convincing victory by Vingegaard. But Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe, they had Mick and Tim van Dijk in there as well, didn't they? And what were they to do? What were they to do? I mean, what are they going to do? Ease up and let the group come back, the weather really made it hard for everybody. And once the time gaps were open, that was kind of it. So they were committed to riding. Could they have worked him over, Vingegaard?
He would have ignored the other two, surely, wouldn't he? I mean, Martinez was the only one who posed any danger whatsoever.
Absolutely.
So he had to follow Martinez's attacks. And Martinez showed later in the week where he stood in the sort of hierarchy of people, how well people were climbing in Paris-Nice. Yeah. He was probably eighth or ninth best climber in the race, maybe. And he comes away with second place.
Well, yeah, on stage five, Martinez was dropped pretty early, wasn't he? And when Vingegaard went away, 20 odd kilometres to go and clinch the stage. You know, I think it's a bit harsh, but because Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe was sort of there, not necessarily by design, really, that it was how it worked out. They couldn't choose to eliminate Vingegaard, because Vingegaard followed the wheels and got himself in there. And once they were all together, I don't think they had any choice but to try and ride and take the best result that they could, which was basically second place, wasn't it?
But they wouldn't have been riding with that mentality. I mean, I don't think they did do anything wrong. You've got to give your leader a chance to win. And we all know, realistically, sitting where we're sitting, that on most days, Jonas Vingegaard is going to smoke him like he did in that final kilometre. But they have to back their leaders, give them confidence. And Dani Martinez is a guy that hasn't had the greatest amount of confidence in the last couple of years. Hasn't been on a World Tour podium since he was second to Bogacar at the Giro. That's almost two seasons ago now. And I think they did a great job. And like you guys have just completely completely rightly stated, he might not have been up there hadn't they continued. So they got themselves a place on the podium. They gave their man confidence by riding for him, pulling off a great job. And just imagine, I mean, the way they were riding, what if Vingegaard had been caught up by that crash or anything like that? They might have won Paris-Nice. So you know, I thought they were doing the completely right thing. You find yourself in that position in an echelon at the start, it's racing, isn't it? You race, full stop.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You go and then you see, there's a moment, isn't there, looking around to see, right, who's made this split, who's made that split. And then all of the plans made earlier in the day or in the team bus have gone out of the window, haven't they? Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe were in a fantastic position to have three riders up there. I think the other thing, you know, sort of retrofitting the argument and deciding whether they rode well or badly based on the results. At the time, Martinez was still in the hunt. You know, everyone was kind of still pretty even, still in the hunt for the overall victory. I mean, the fact that he ended up losing 40-odd seconds, I think the gap between him and Vingegaard on the row, you know, on the GC as they were riding, was probably only about 12 or 15 seconds. So, you know, he's still bang in the hunt for the GC. So it's a case of risk and reward. Would Tim van Dijk and Mick van Dijk have, you know, if they tried to triple up on Vingegaard, would it have had a different outcome? Very possibly not. Daniel, as you say, all that Vingegaard needed to really do would be follow Martinez and then hit him at some point on the final kilometre and a half to the line, and the result probably wouldn't have been any different. Vingegaard, for his part, rode very smartly, very strongly. I mean, looked appalling, but rode very well.
I, at the end of the week, or based on what we saw, I've sort of divided, well, I've done two lists, stock rising, stock falling. I thought Jonas Vingegaard, to be honest, I thought Jonas Vingegaard's stock was sort of under-indexed, underestimated as we went into Paris-Nice, because people forget very quickly, I think, just, you know, well, they forget his pedigree, they forget what he's done in Tours de France before, they sort of impose their imagined narratives on his future, and it's very easy to see Sexas riding extremely well last few weeks, Remco starting the season so well, and to sort of redraw the world order and forget just how good Jonas Vingegaard is, and he's the only guy who has really challenged Tadej Pogacar over the last few weeks. So I thought people were sort of writing him off over the last few weeks, and I expected us to see, I thought we would see a really good performance by Vingegaard, and we did see a really good performance. I think stock rising as well for me was Visma in general. I think Victor Campenaerts looked really strong. Bruno Almirai looked really strong, but I expected him to be really strong this year. He'll be a good signing. I also really enjoyed Axel Zingler's huge tantrum on the bike,
yes,
on the day that Tejada won, audibly very frustrated with the fact. I don't know whether he's frustrated with his teammates for riding on the front at that point and sort of cutting him adrift, or he's frustrated at himself for sort of losing contact. But I always enjoy a bit of on the bike petulance, so I quite enjoyed that. Chaps already touched on it, but another stock rising for me was ASO. Given the circumstances that Rob has just described, particularly those elections in Nice, they couldn't finish on the Promenade des Anglais. That meant that they'd had to do something different with the last stage. On paper, it looked underwhelming, the profile for the last stage, but they'd sort of discovered this new climb, the Linguador, which is just sort of off the, when you go down the Var River back into Nice, it was just off to the right, and it was interesting. It was, well, we saw some good racing on there, Martinez and Vingegaard going away, but generally speaking, at the risk of repeating myself, I thought it was a really exciting week of racing. And the another stock rising for me was the team time trial again. I know that some people don't like this format, but purely the implosion of Decathlon made it really compelling viewing, I thought, and it just sort of brought into focus what an interesting discipline. I mean, you could argue that something similar would have happened anyway with traditional rules. I'm not sure that's the case, but what we did have was Dan Hohler, who was clearly in absolutely banging form. He rode away from all his teammates. They'd set the fastest time at the first split, and they were, I think, all together at that point.
All seven.
And then in the next kilometre or two, they lost all of their pieces. And Dan Hohler was faced with a decision. I suppose he could have tried to wait for, it was Prodom, wasn't it, who was the GC leader. Decided not to, and then rode solo, and still, I think at that point, set the fastest time. He didn't win the team time trial solo. He was surpassed. But that was a good, as I say, compelling watch, I thought.
Yeah, we're not really used to this format on a team time trial that doesn't finish with a climb, really, are we? It was that was what kind of threw everybody a bit, I suppose. And yeah, his, well, decathlon in the end, their time was only 11 seconds adrift of Ineos Grenadiers, who, well, they kept it together much more so, didn't they?
And their week fell apart after that as well, did Decathlon? Because Prodhomme suddenly loses touch with the GC. Then you have the bad weather day. Ola falls off. And it turned in, and after what looked like a really promising start for them, good squad, and you think Prodhomme last year, he's suddenly become a GC guy and all this sort of stuff. You're thinking he could finish in the top 5 or 10 in a Paris-Nice, and it's a good result. They might win a stage with a sprinter. Ball was going all right, you know, the classic-y stages and things like that. And then in 24 hours, their race just fell apart. So it just shows that you underestimate a discipline a bit like this, or not even underestimate it, you just have a bad day. I'm sure they prepared wonderfully because they were obviously going all right and they'd spent time in a Formula One track and all that sort of stuff leading up to it. And then you just have one bad day, the confidence goes, the heads go down, riders crash out, and it's sort of the end of the race for you. But this discipline is going to be in the Tour de France this year. Opening stage with the uphill finish. I know some people don't like it, and I sort of understand the reasons why some people don't like it, because, you know, the idea is to keep your GC guy there and, you know, work as a team with the strengths and the weaknesses. In this sort of discipline, you sort of just play into the strengths, aren't you, to try and get the best time. As a commentator, I love it because it's exciting. As a viewer, I love it. But I can also understand why people like the intricacies of the sort of more traditional team time trial. In terms of pure entertainment, maybe in this modern era of us wanting that quick dopamine hit and the little quick clips and all that sort of stuff, or low attention spans, this is probably team time trialing for the TikTok generation, isn't it?
To be honest, I think it reminds me of Francois Tomazo's comment about what road racing is, a team sport practiced by individuals or an individual sport practiced by teams. And I think we saw for the first time really evidence of a sort of tactical differences, tactical sophistication in how the different teams were going to approach it. And I think with the Tour de France in July, we might see some slightly more radical approaches, because obviously the whole goal really in the Tour de France especially will be to make sure that the GC riders get the best possible results against one another. And how do you use the other members of your team to achieve that result? And so I think it's maybe a little bit tricky to kind of work out what's going on in real time, maybe. Whereas a team time trial in the old fashion sense of, you know, whatever it is, fourth or fifth man over the line, that's your team's time. There's a kind of very obvious, as you say, Rob, protection of the weaker members and making sure you get your fifth man over the line as quickly as possible. Whereas this is about propelling your best riders to the line as quickly as possible. I mean, look at the way that the GC riders, you know, Kevin Vauclain and Oscar Onley, Juan Ayuso for Lidl Trek, trying to get the best possible result that they can. Whereas Decathlon, who didn't really have a GC rider, yes, you know, maybe they were trying for the stage win and were trying something slightly different with Dan Hauler.
Lionel, just as, you know, you talk about what professional cycling is there, and in terms of sort of explaining or visually, graphically representing to a lay audience what professional cycling is, I also think it's a good discipline in that it does graphically sort of represent what the role of the team is in service of the leader. And there's an element of the sort of bullfighter kind of swooshing back their silk and the leader appearing, and in an age, you know, we've often talked about how in an era when helmets are compulsory and the fact that you can't see the riders' faces anymore, that maybe creates a bit of a sort of disconnect between the race and the audience, and they don't maybe connect with the leaders in the same way as they perhaps once did. I think it's kind of nice to see almost the leader. Rob, you used the phrase as a sort of limousine ride earlier, talking about Red Bull, but the leader sort of positioned and thrust towards the front and unleashed. And I think, again, that is helpful for the spectacle and helpful in terms of what, you know, what that particular discipline is supposed to kind of communicate to the audience. I like it.
Another thing that perhaps really illustrated it was EF Education Easy Post had the yellow jersey with Luke Lamperti, didn't they? And, you know, he finished about 3 minutes behind. You know, their strategy was not a defensive one of, like, let's just try and get Luke Lamperti round. There was almost an unwritten, with the old team time trial format, the more traditional one, a sort of unwritten rule that you would have to kind of shepherd the yellow jersey round, whereas they raced it very differently and, you know, got a better team result as a result of that. We kind of have to rewrite in our minds what a team time trial is with these rules, especially with the Tour de France. You know, they'll be coming at it, you know, everybody equal on time on the opening day of the Tour. And really it will be up for grabs. There'll be lots of things at play, stage win for some, GC results for others. And I think it'll be really interesting to see. It might be quite frustrating for some team time trial specialists or time trial specialists. I'm thinking of Victor Campenaerts, for example, you know, didn't finish in the lead group of Visma Lisa bike riders, lost some time, but was working very hard to get the best possible time for his leaders. And so it's a little bit like you have to squint to see what's going on occasionally. You know, you would expect Campenaerts to be one of the best time trialists, but he's not finishing at the front, leading them over the line with all that strength and power because his job had been done a little bit earlier. And I think we'll probably become more aware of those kind of subtleties.
Two things really quickly, just to continue that point. You're basically touching on something I wanted to mention. Looking ahead to the Tour de France, yes, you've got all the different sort of factors at play, as you just explained, Lionel, but, you know, if you're a team that tactically wants to have two or three riders up in the general classification in the first week to try and take it to Pogacar or Vingegaard or whoever and play those cards, you've got to make that decision on day one how many GC riders finish up there as well. That is a really important thing, and that might affect how quickly you go earlier on in the stage, because how many resources do you commit? Do you have other domestiques who work even harder on day one than you'd normally expect? They might then tire in a few days. All sorts of things to go into it. And the other brief point, you know that Sean Kelly has seen a lot of bike races. We finished commentated on that the other day, and we just looked at each other and said, wow, how good was that sort of thing? So it was such a good spectacle. And for that reason, I think I'm all for it.
Much more going on, I think. That's the thing, isn't it? There's a lot more of interest. It's not just teams of seven or eight trundling round, which the team time trial format that we're more used to occasionally looks like that.
Well, we are referring a lot to the first stage of the Tour de France. Just to remind people, it's 19 kilometres and finishes up in Montjuïc in Barcelona. But that sort of reverts a little bit more to the format we've seen in Paris-Nice before with climb. In this case, it's two climbs, really, up to Montjuïc, up to the finish, which is there's sort of 4 kilometres of climbing and descending at the end. You would look at that profile and think that that's where the leaders are likely to be unleashed, but we saw in Paris-Nice that it doesn't. You don't necessarily need a climb, and it doesn't necessarily need to be right at the end. You might get situations much earlier on, even after 10 or 12 kilometres, if the team decides to go really hard at the start. You might get riders, team leaders sort of isolated or with one or two teammates with 5 or 6 kilometres to go. Anyway, chaps, that was Paris-Nice. My other stock falling. I don't want to dwell too much on the negative. I thought it was a bad week for Biniam Gamay. It made a real hash of the first couple of sprints when I thought there were real opportunities for him. It wasn't the strongest sprint field, particularly with the profiles of those first couple of stages, which really were the climbs at the end. Not big climbs, but they really did thin out the sort of sprinter's field. And Biniam Gamay had two really good opportunities. Unfortunately, didn't take them.
With a few other things we've just got to mention from Paris-Nice, really, because that team time trial put Juan Ayuso into the race lead for Lidl Trek, setting him up for a great week, and then unfortunately crashed on day four, crashed out, went to hospital. A real kind of blow to, because I think we were looking forward to seeing how Ayuso would go leading Lidl Trek in a big stage race up against a flying Jonas Vingegaard. And Oscar Onley as well. He was in one of those early splits on that stage four, wasn't he? In a great position, but then crash and mechanical problems and lost a bit of time. And, well, I mean, everybody lost a lot of time on that day. And just lastly, I mean, you mentioned Harald Tejada. I mean, what a great week for him and for XDS Astana winning a stage with Max Kanter as well. Two stage wins, and Teyada riding very well overall. Where was he overall? He was, he's 10th. He wasn't quite as well. He didn't do quite as well overall, but
He had problems on the last stage.
That's right, yeah.
So that was Paris-Nice, chaps. I meant to look this up earlier. Was Vingegaard the first Danish winner of Paris-Nice? I think I've looked at that before, that no Dane had ever won Paris-Nice. That may have been the case. That may not. We might update you on that later in the episode. Tirreno Adriatico, chaps. We'd also looked at that route, the profiles of that route before the week before the racing started. And we said it was a bit of a throwback to the edition of the early 2000s, a route that looked likely to suit the kind of punchers, maybe more so than the general classification riders, who have been to their advantage in more recent editions of Tirreno, with some big mountain finishes in the last sort of 10 years or so in Tirreno. Not the case this year, but as I said earlier, well, I enjoyed it. The sort of nostalgia piece I enjoyed, because it did remind me of what Tirreno used to be, when the likes of Paolo Bettini were winning, Filippo Pozzato, Oscar Freire, they were winning stages. So I enjoyed that. And I thought just generally, objectively speaking, there was great racing on most, if not all days, except the last stage, which is, Rob and I were discussing this the other day. It is a bit of a, I don't want to say a crime against race design, but I understand that RCS have to finish in San Benedetto del Tronto on the Adriatic.
You're not going
to
use
coast,
his nickname.
But sorry?
You're not going to use the town's nickname.
Yeah, no, we're not going to use the town's nickname. But to have such an uneventful sprint stage on the last day, on a Sunday, the race used to finish on a weekday, but it now finishes on the weekend. I just think it's a bit of a shame when the character of the race, the identity of the race, is these, particularly in the Marche region, it is these short, steep climbs. And there are lots of them. There are many of them that the race could use just inland from San Benedetto de Tronto. And it's one of these things that just seems incoherent in professional cycling, that you have a race as big as Tirreno and it finishes on such, as far as I'm concerned, such a sort of bum note. Anyway, that aside, Rob, can you, I know you weren't commentating on it, but do you want to give us a quick summary of stage winners and what happened and who won?
Of course, I've always got my eye on it, because it's a bit cruel, isn't it, making you decide between Paris-Nice and Tirreno Adriatico. When I started my career, Tirreno was my favourite. And then after spending so many with Monsieur Paris-Nice at Paris-Nice, I've sort of changed. But Tirreno is still a great race. It's a beautiful race. It's Italy. It's proper Italy, isn't it? Deep Italy. And it began with an Italian winning. Lido di Camaiore often has the time trial at the start, doesn't it? On occasion, it's been team time trial individual. But, you know, when it's individual, it's almost a given that Filippo Ganna wins a time trial at Tirreno. He did the same there. He was in the blue leader's jersey early on, until day two, when Mathieu van der Poel turned up and won. Lots of gravel race and a really exciting gravel stage, actually. Just a few days after Strade Bianche, there was a section towards the end of the race, finished in glorious San Gimignano. Many of you have been on your holidays to Tuscany will know the place. It's got a load of towers around and beautiful old medieval town. The day after, Tobias Lund continued his brilliant step forward, if you like, this season. He beat some brilliant big-name sprinters, the likes of Milan, Dali, Manier, and the rest to glory. Van der Poel won again on stage four, and Isaac Del Toro had been in the blue jersey. He briefly lost it, though. Very briefly lost it to Giulio Pellizzari before gaining it back. That was after Michael Valgren won a stage from a breakaway, and that was a really sort of, it was a good news story of the week, wasn't it? Because he's been injured for a long, long time after that shocking crash, which I think happened in about 4 or 5 years ago now, 2022 maybe.
It was in the Rue du Sud.
Yeah, and before that, let's not forget, this is a rider who'd enjoyed, I think, his best season about 2018. He won the Omloppet Nieuwsblad and the Amstel Gold Race in the same year. After his crash, he dropped down to the development team for a year and rode with the kids, if you like, in the under-21s, with small races, bringing them through, getting back to fitness. And he's been close a few times, but he won that stage 5. That was in Mumbai Ocho, another one of these up and down all day stages that Daniel was just talking about. And the Marche is the perfect region for that, isn't it? You know, you start in Tuscany, go to the Marche, which is a very similar region to Tuscany without being as famous. Glorious little hilltop towns. Another of those was Camerino, a day that started in San Severino Marche. This was Giulio Pellizzari's hometown day, but it was his mate and his flatmate and neighbour up in San Marino who beat him. Isaac del Toro secured the winner's trident and became the master of the two seas when he won stage 6. On the final day, Mathieu van der Poel was in sort of training mode, I think, for San Remo. He did this big long climb and effort for about 25 minutes. But as Daniel was just saying, it's not the best design in San Benedetto, as they call it in Italy. Sort of the Blackpool of that region of Italy, if you like. Out of season, if you've had to stay there in a hotel.
It's pretty bleak.
Yeah.
I mean, you say...
Nothing wrong with Blackpool, Rob.
Listen, I've been going there 55 times a year since I was conceived, as all Lancastrians do. But, you know, we get a bit fed up of it. Don't go in that sea, your legs will dissolve. Was that Peter Kay said? But yeah, San Benedetto del Tronto... pardon me, I just almost went for the wrong one then. San Benedetto del Tronto, out of season. You go in these hotels, the heating's not even on. You struggle to get some food. They don't want you there.
Oh,
it's a bit miserable.
Me.
It's damp. Dear it's horrible. But it is, if you go back into the hills, as Daniel and I were discussing the other day, you can find some glorious places. It's on one of those hills that Van der Poel did this crazy sort of move. He dropped most of the sprinters, including his own sprinter. But then it came back together. There was an intermediate sprint that did change something along the way. Matteo Jorgensen took some bonus seconds. He finished second on the GC, just ahead of Giulio Pellizzari, with Del Toro winning. And Jonathan Milan won a sprint. And that's something else that I guess wouldn't be a Tirreno if Jonathan Milan didn't win a sprint. So that was that, and it was a blinking good race, wasn't it?
Yes, it was an excellent race, won by Isaac del Toro, who was just very impressive, I thought. He has a slightly idiosyncratic way of riding. It either looks a little bit sort of languid and he looks a little bit slow to react at times, or you could take the alternative view and say that he's just very, very mature and he knows his body and he knows exactly what he can do. Particularly, I thought that the climb up to Camerino, when he did sort of dash Pellizzari's hopes there, and Pellizzari, as you said, Rob, the hometown boy, and he looked well set to win that stage at one point on the final climb, very steep final climb into the old town, and Del Toro just bided his time, as he tends to do, and he made light work of Pellizzari and everyone else, and that seems to be his style, and his stock has risen further as a result of Tirreno. I would suggest it was interesting. I'm talking about Pellizzari was very impressive the whole week. I thought what is most impressive about him, and has been since he emerged a couple of years ago, is his consistency. On the day, it was the day before Camerino, on one of the days he certainly looked as though he was suffering on the climbs, and it almost looked as though his kind of resolve had been broken in the race and he would be in free fall thereafter. And then the following day he was back where he had been, sort of on Del Toro's heels. And this is something I've noticed about him, that he doesn't seem to, well, he doesn't capitulate. And obviously, for someone who aspires to win Grand Tours, that is a key ability to have. And I said at the start of the year in the predictions episode, I think he's going to be Jonas Vingegaard's main threat in the Giro d'Italia. And I sort of stand by that after Tirreno and everything we've seen from Pellizzari so far this year. So stock rising for Giulio Pellizzari as well as Isaac del Toro for my money. And also, poor Matteo Jorgensen, who kind of poked fun at his own inability to sprint. As you said, Rob, he did gain some time on the final stage in that intermediate sprint, and he said it's maybe the only sprint I've ever won in my life, and he got a great lead out that day from Wout van Aert at that intermediate sprint. He unfortunately does not have that ability. He's not as explosive as a lot of the riders he's competing against, but he's impressed me as well at the start of the season. As we know, he's changed his racing program and he's favouring the Ardennes Classics more than the Cobble Classics. Well, he's not doing the Cobble Classics this year, but so far, he looks as though he's riding very well.
Listen, you win two Paris-Nice in a row, then you finish second in Tirreno in the third year. Usually go all right in March, and that just shows what a good 1 week stage racer he's suddenly become.
even though he should be barred from Italy for putting things like, I don't know, fried eggs on gnocchi or something like that? It was some heinous interpretation of gnocchi anyway that I saw on a video a few weeks ago that a lot of other people saw as well.
Given the fact that Tirreno Adriatico, especially this year, was much more of a sort of classics style of racing, wasn't it? The stages won by Mathieu van der Poel, for example, very classic in their kind of tempo and feel. I thought Jorgensen had a great week. I mean, that was a really outstanding, consistent performance. Another rider I thought did well, and the whole team did well, really. Tobias Halland-Johannessen, who was fourth, kind of best of the rest, really. But it was all about Del Toro, wasn't it? I mean, we talked him up last week, I think, saying that he would be the outstanding favourite for this race, and so it proved. And I think you're right, Daniel, you know, no sort of sense of panic. When Pellizzari got that time bonus in the stage when he finished second behind Van der Poel to nick the leader's jersey, I didn't have any sense that, oh, well, that's gonna unseat Del Toro. I just looked at the profiles of the remaining stages and thought that there would be opportunities for him. And he takes that approach on a sort of macro and micro level, doesn't he? We've seen him, you know, drifting backwards a little bit and just waiting until it's his time to make his effort. He clearly got a very good handle on what he can produce and how long he can produce it over, and it was a really mature performance and a continuation of what has been a fantastic 12 months, really, because it's a year ago this equivalent day, isn't it, that he won Milano Torino and his jersey zip malfunctioned, and you know, he almost did a Jonas Vingegaard with some kind of crime against fashion, didn't he? Yeah, he's looking very good, and I think the Tirreno Adriatico week's given us probably more clues about the forthcoming Milan San Remo on Saturday than Paris-Nice did. A couple of very significant rides, I felt, by Van der Poel and Del Toro.
Chaps, one other footnote I wanted to mention from Tirreno I wanted to ask you about. What did you make of Primoz Roglic at Tirreno? Were we enjoying or were we not enjoying?
Fifth overall,
but I said that Del Toro is idiosyncratic. It was an idiosyncratic sort of week for Roglic. Sometimes he was sort of drifting behind Pellizzari, conspicuously not really helping him. Sometimes he looked as though he was giving him pep talks on the bike and doing a sort of a really invaluable job. Sometimes it looked like, from glimpses, brief moments, fleeting moments, it looked like the Roglic of old, and you thought, oh, he's going to sort of Roglify everyone here and this is going to be the Rog remontada, and it didn't really materialize. But and at the end of the week, fifth place, a pretty decent result, but then he sort of, well, he signed off by telling everyone, or reminding everyone, because I think we knew this already, that his next appearance is going to be in Romandy, and thereafter we're not going to see him again until the Vuelta a España.
Holidays. Ah, we are retiring, huh? Oh.
Yeah, we are retiring.
A sort of teammate in the sense that he was wearing the same jersey at times, but perhaps not a lot more. But then, you know, Roglic has kind of earned that position, I guess, hasn't he?
Listen, he's still waiting to be paid back from when he got him to the lounge in Mallorca that time in the airport. Remember that, when we were doing the podcast?
Yeah, I do vaguely remember that.
Rog managed to sneak him into the lounge.
Yeah, yeah. Did we hear him on the podcast? I think we did, didn't we?
In the background, yeah, we did. Yeah, yeah.
Before we wrap up these two races, can I indulge in a slight flight of fancy?
Please do.
Because now that the two races, they used to kind of overlap, didn't they? As you said, Daniel, Tirreno Adriatico used to run on a bit longer and finish on the Wednesday before Milan-San Remo. Now they run much more side by side. Tirreno Adriatico is a day shorter than Paris-Nice. And I think when you look at the whole week's racing, and Daniel, I've become obsessed with the UCI points as well now, because I totted them all up and Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe outscored everybody else despite not winning either GC. They got 1,395 points. Visma Lisa Bike got 1,310 points.
Which I think, Lionel, is more or less akin to winning a Tour de France.
It's around that, isn't it? Yeah, that's for Vingegaard winning Paris-Nice and everything else. UAE Team Emirates won 961 points, heavily weighted with Tirreno Adriatico. They didn't perform terribly well at Paris-Nice. They only got 229 points at Paris-Nice as opposed to 732 at Tirreno Adriatico. And, well, down at the bottom, real difficult week for Picnic Post NL. Only 27 points accrued over the two races. The worst of the World Tour teams. Lotto Antimarché not an awful lot better, 103. And there were some teams in the middle of the pack, you know, Jayco Alula, Alpecin de Premier Tech, Sudal Quickstep, in the sort of 200 range. But it did strike me that there's an opportunity here with these two races. I wonder whether there shouldn't be some sort of spring week overarching competition, some kind of team classification based on the two races, which might re-inject another dynamic to...
Why? Who would care about
well,
that?
Well, we would.
You would. You would.
I think it would do...
No one else would give a single stuff about that.
All right, well, maybe have a just one classification and you win points in either race, and then you could choose which race you send your riders to, target your points. I mean, look, we've got to think outside of the box to capture the imagination here.
Well, we've already got people arguing about whether UCI rankings themselves are meaningless nonsense. I would suggest we don't need another barometer of meaningless nonsense.
It would do less harm to the sport's reputation than a former Tour de France winner wearing his bib tights outside his jersey, is what I'm saying.
I would suggest that one of the organisers, who has a lot of power in cycling, is a little kinder to the other organiser, and they can coordinate their television schedules a bit better. Then we can watch more of both of them. We'll leave that there.
I think we need to stick a Tirreno Adriatico trident in this debate and move on.
This episode is also sponsored by Saily, which is an eSIM which can help you to reduce or even eliminate the cost of using your mobile phone when you're abroad. Because let's face it, when you're travelling, either on holiday or for work, you probably want to use your phone as if you're at home, keeping in touch with people, using social media, downloading podcasts, or even watching your favourite streaming services. And all of that data use can add up to quite a significant bill if you're not on the right tariff. Well, an eSIM from Saily can help you to keep a lid on those costs and know exactly what you're spending. And it's simple to use too, without any physical hardware. You don't have to buy a new SIM card and swap it with your existing one in your phone. It's an eSIM that only needs to be installed once, and then you select the plan which covers the countries that you're travelling to. It's got an inbuilt ad blocker too, which stops browser ads from loading, and that can reduce your data usage. And because it comes to you from NordVPN, it's got a built-in VPN. So security and privacy are the watchwords, and you can block malicious ads, change your virtual location, and stay safer when you're using the internet on your phone. You can get an exclusive 15% discount on your first Saily data plan by using the code CYCLING at the checkout. The best way to do that is to download the Saily app from your app store or go to saily.com/cycling. That's saily.com/cycling.
Well, chaps, we've reviewed three cracking races that happened last week. And on the horizon, we've got the one-day race, which I regularly, or I have in the past, called my favourite race of the year. It is Milano-San Remo, which has been sort of, I suppose, recharacterised and been the subject of very favourable revisionism over the last few years. I think en masse, everyone has decided that it's their favourite one-day race of the year as of about 2 years ago, having previously decried it as the most boring race on the professional cycling calendar. A lot of that revisionism is thanks to Tadej Pogacar, I suppose, and Mathieu van der Poel as well. The excitement they've re-injected back into Milan-San Remo, but we're certainly very excited. Another man who's very excited, although we're not yet on his home patch, is Hugo Corvitz, the star and the voice of Corvitz Corner, and that's where we're going right now.
Pay attention, Freebie. I have a love-hate relationship with Milan-San Remo. Even though this is the very first monument of the cycling year, I can't wait until the riders have passed the Via Roma, because the Flemish races are just around the corner. The Primavera reminds me of a pressure cooker, although it is only brought out after a 271-kilometer long prelude. It's a waiting game until the peloton has arrived in San Lorenzo al Mare. I expect Tadej Pogačar to set the kitchen on fire there again, and that Mathieu van der Poel and possibly Filippo Ganna will accept his invitation. Yes, exactly the same people from last year. If they can follow him there and also on the Poggio, they stand a chance of winning the Classicissima. If they don't succeed, Pogačar can finally wipe the zero from Milan-San Remo. It is that simple. I see only two super favorites: Tadej Pogačar and reigning winner Mathieu van der Poel. A good Pidcock should be able to keep up, while Isaac Del Toro could be useful in Pogačar's tactical game after the Cipressa. About Van Aert, improving in form is a question mark for me. If he can follow Ganna, the former winner will go very far. Actually, Poggi is a lucky boy that the Cipressa has been part of Milan-San Remo since 1982. And at Imerx's time, he had to make do with just the Poggio. As a child, I watched his 7 victories live on black and white television. The cannibal started 10 times. He won 7 times and finished only 8 once. The greatest of all time did it in every possible way. You were never done with him on the Via Roma. As a teenager, nothing beat the Classicissima for me, because my idol Merckx won almost every time. By comparison, Pogačar is starting for the 6th time this Saturday. He finished 3rd 2 years in a row. So, a lot of water has to flow under the bridge before Poggi becomes the GOAT. And don't say there is more competition now than before. His only real challenger is 2-time winner Mathieu van der Poel.
Well, chaps, Hugo already spitting teeth at the idea that come Saturday evening, Tadej Pogačar will finally have broken this Milan-San Remo hoodoo, won La Classicissima, and furthered his case, strengthened his case to be considered the greatest of all time, the GOAT. The superior of Eddie Merckx, who of course won Milan-San Remo 7 times. Hugo's not on board with this, chaps. Do you agree? Would it strengthen? Would it close the case? Would Tadej Pogačar be indisputably the greatest of all time if he wins on Saturday?
Not yet. Oof.
Not yet.
No.
I think until he retires. I mean, yeah, we're increasingly having this debate, and I'm doing it on commentary as well, because I think we sort of need to introduce it. But I think a definitive judgment can't be reached until he retires.
It's great for the sport, though, isn't it? Because this is the biggest sort of cliffhanger in professional cycling. This is the kind of Hitchcockian cliffhanger in professional cycling at the present moment. In other sports, you have these questions that seem to loom over sports at particular time in golf, and I know I often talk about golf, but there's often a question about who is the greatest player in the world not to have won a major, and then when they do, you know, it's a huge moment in the history of the sport. We've had that with the likes of Phil Mickelson, who's a sort of prominent recent example for the last 20 years anyway. In cycling's case, in Milan-San Remo and Pogačar's case, this is that cliffhanger, isn't it? It's the biggest sort of question, I would suggest. Maybe the other big question is who is going to be Pogačar's successor as a Tour de France winner. But that aside, this is the question that we're all sort of waiting to see whether we're going to get an affirmative answer to.
Yeah, I mean, he's ridden 5 times Milan-San Remo. His results are 12th, 5th, 4th and 3rd in each of the last 2 years, you know, inching closer. And it's that great old cliche, it's not necessarily a whodunit, but a howdunit, Milan-San Remo. The question is, how could he win on Saturday? I mean, last year we saw them go on the Cipressa, didn't we? And he had Mathieu van der Poel and Filippo Ganna for company. They distanced Ganna a bit on the Poggio. And the question from a long way out was, well, how does Pogačar either get rid of Mathieu van der Poel or beat him in a sprint? And I suspect the question will be similar this year, won't it? And we saw in Tirreno Adriatico, Van der Poel just flexing. Like, the way he won those 2 sprints, especially the second one, where he went from so far back, I felt. It was a real long sprint, that, from Van der Poel. You referenced the kind of the pointless breakaway or the pointless move. And he's just stretching his legs just to see exactly where he stands. And then on the flip side, we've got Pogacar. We've got him with a very, very strong team. Isaac Del Toro, also in fantastic form, is clearly going to be a factor, an advantage for UAE Team Emirates to have more than one rider capable of perhaps even winning Milan-San Remo. But it's just, how does he sort of solve this jigsaw puzzle? You know, he tried from the Cipressa. Does he... Weirdly, I was thinking this morning, does he actually need a bigger group from further out, but one that kind of goes and sticks, and then it becomes a bit more tactical and it becomes a few more left field possibilities that would more likely put Van der Poel on the back foot and help Pogacar to maybe get away?
Lionel, you mentioned his results. Just before we hear what Rob thinks, maybe useful to recap the sort of method that he has employed in San Remo thus far. So in 2020, he was 12th and didn't really see him. It was his first time. I guess he was sort of feeling his way in Milan-San Remo. 2021, he didn't ride. 2022, his first sort of concerted attempt. UAE with Pollant, Yang Pollant and Davide Formolo, they set a fast pace on the Cipressa, but about a dozen riders went over the summit. There were no attacks. And then there were multiple attacks by Pogacar on the pod. At the top of the Poggio, there were four riders with a tiny gap, including Pogacar, tiny gap. And then Matej Mohoric came from behind, attacked on the descent, won. Pogacar was fifth. 2023, he tried pretty much the same. Wasn't effective. There was a huge group over the summit of the Cipressa, and he tried a sort of death blow, the coup de grâce on the Poggio. Ganna, Van Aert and Van der Poel went with him, but Van der Poel then countered, had a few seconds over the summit, and then he won. Van der Poel won solo, Pogacar was fourth. 2024, nothing much happened on the Cipressa. Tried to set a fast pace on the Poggio. Wellens tried to launch Pogacar again. This was the sort of one kind of death blow tactic, a nuclear attack. Didn't really work. And then he tried again on the Poggio 500 meters before the summit. Got a significant gap, actually, but Van der Poel chased him down, sacrificed himself for Philipsen, who then won. Pogacar got third in the bunch sprint. And then, Lionel, you described what happened last year. So those are the sort of things he tried. He seems to have settled, and we're going to hear in a minute about what he might be planning on the Cipressa, but he seems to have settled on this formula of softening everyone up on the Cipressa. We've heard about this kind of mythical 9-minute barrier on the Cipressa. They feel that they need to go under 9 minutes, and he's done it in training. I think he did it in the race as well last year.
He did.
Soften people up on the Cipressa, maybe go away with a couple of riders. And as you say, Lionel, this is something that's occurred to me as well. Maybe it doesn't serve him to be in a group as small as he was last year. There were three of them on the Poggio last year. And then it's obvious where the attack is going to come from. It's obvious that who Van der Poel has to look at. There's no element of surprise. Whereas I mentioned that occasion, 2024, when he did get a significant gap on the Poggio, that was from quite a big group, and it was almost as though Van der Poel was taken by surprise. And it wasn't enough, but it was encouraging, I thought.
I think what he's tried to do in every single year so far, I don't think it's gone according to plan. So if you think back the Cipressa, in almost every entry into the Cipressa, they haven't had the whole team, the whole train, positioned as they would like. And this is, I think, maybe going to be the issue this weekend. Certainly with someone like Del Toro, who seems to... That's his sort of weak point. He seems to struggle a little with positioning. If you think last year, not everybody was in the right position. A couple of years ago, it was the same, going into both Cipressa and Poggio. And you can understand why, because they're the two key points in the race where everybody fights for position. We get to the bottom of the Poggio in particular, that right turn off the road. It's like the most electrifying 10 minutes of the season, isn't it? If they could get somehow the whole team with that sort of great lineup of climbers to do silly, silly watts and silly things on Cipressa, then they could really blow the race apart. I just don't think... I mean, the plan's been there. I think they have the ability to do that, but it hasn't really come off as they want. And this weekend, missing Narváez, missing Wellens, who the two guys who can provide that explosive thing, and two riders who position themselves well, they've been replaced by Del Toro and Jan Christen, who historically aren't great at that. They've got the power, they're unbelievable bike riders, but they're not really sort of the guys who you think, oh, well, they're going to be first into the Molenberg, they're going to be first onto the Poggio, things like that.
Rob, where does McNulty fit in? He's not done Milan San Remo before, but he's been drafted in. And I was going to ask you, actually, do you know why Nils Paulet is not riding?
I don't know why. I know that Paris. He is riding. He is riding in the Northern Classics, actually. So he's riding Nokere and Coxer and Dunant, I think, as well.
So it might, chaps, take something different. I mean, one other thing that I don't know whether I mentioned about last year, Lionel, 2025, there was a clear mistake in the sprint. And I know people assume, and if people have sort of written off Pogacar's potential to win a sprint against Van der Poel. Part of me still thinks that might be fruitful in the future. You know, Pogacar, the thing the consensus is that he's maybe not as quick. He's getting slow with age, and that's what happens with most people. But, you know, the guy still won a bunch sprint at the Dauphiné last year. Okay, it was an unusual bunch sprint. But we've seen riders sort of upset the form book on Vierama before. Pogacar himself has finished sort of third in bunch sprints. And last year, the mistake he made was he laid off. He gave Ganna and Van der Poel, I don't know, 30 metres. And he consequently was never able to make it back up to their wheel. And that was really why he got beaten so comprehensively in the sprint. So, well, we've discussed Cipressa, Poggio, what he's done in the past. So what else could he possibly try? Yesterday, I spoke to a former winner of Milan-San Remo, who won in a slightly unusual fashion. I'm talking about Filippo Pozzato. Pozzato was able to win because he had really two riders in his team who were marked men, Paolo Bettini and Tom Bonner. And Pozzato sort of was able to exploit benefit from everyone's attention being elsewhere. However, this is what Pozzato thinks that Pogacar should maybe try this year.
Non è l'unica opzione, però è la strada più.
He could try doing what he did last year, but it's not the only option. Let's say it's the easiest way to guarantee him a chance of winning. But certainly in his place, with such a strong team, if they ride entirely and solely for him, because I don't know where Del Toro fits in, I would start attacking as early as the Turchino. Because if you go full gas there, in my opinion, not many expect it. No one has been doing it over the last few years. But with their team's potential, they're capable of it, and it'll already start to hurt people. Then, of course, they have to ride all the Capi hard, and they need to ride the Cipressa like they did last year. With the legs Pogacar has, in fact, I'd attack right from the bottom of the Cipressa. The problem is figuring out which way the wind will be blowing, because a headwind makes a tactic like that much harder to pull off. But with his legs, it's the only solution he has to try and wear out the others. You saw Van der Poel last year. As much as he might have suffered on the Cipressa to stay on Pogacar's wheel, in the end, he managed to attack right back in Pogacar's face. Maybe just to show him that he wasn't struggling. The year I won, we also did the Turchino hard. The average speed was really high. In fact, apart from last year when they went even quicker, I think it was the second highest ever. You maybe have to squint to see how the Turchino could make a difference, but someone like Pogacar, who can afford to do 80 kilometers alone like he did at Strade Bianche, if I had his legs, I'd be bold enough to try it. Also because he has nothing to lose. I mean, if nothing else, you put on a show.
È un qualcosa in più per inventarsi, per fare spettacolo.
Well, chaps, this is a radical strategy that Pippo Pozzato is suggesting. He's suggesting a sort of full-bore attack from UAE on the Turchino.
Has he been talking to Beppe Conte or something like that?
Well, the Turchino, I'll just remind people. So it comes, the summit of the Turchino is after 138 kilometres, which is how many kilometres from the finish?
It's over 150 from the finish.
Hey, faster copy did it. Why not Pog?
It's a very modest climb. 25 kilometers long, but it only climbs 373 meters. Average gradient of 1.4%. So if you sort of blink, you'll miss the Turchino. I mean, chaps, thinking about Pogacar and Van der Poel and how this route suits or does not suit the respective riders, it sort of brings to mind for me. Remember the that sort of format for cooking quiz show program, Ready Steady Cook, that sort of thing, where people are given a set of ingredients and they have to make something that's sort of master chef. They have to make something from these ingredients. I kind of imagine Vanderpool, you know, with the abilities that he has, he sort of opens the fridge and it's kind of bursting with scallops and truffles and caviar. And Pogacar kind of opens his fridge and it's a glass of milk and a dusty radish. There's
tin of anchovies.
Well, yeah. And he's got to conjure something to the extent that now people Pozzato is suggesting that he tries something on the Turchino, which we've never really seen. I mean, there was when Claudio Chiappucci won Sanremo in the early 90s, there was a move on the Turchino. Then that day the weather was dreadful and that helped. I doubt, unfortunately, that this is going to be a winning strategy.
Well, I certainly don't think going from the Turchino has got any possibility at all. I mean, but if UAE Team Emirates really tried to make the Turchino hard, very, very hard, and just sort of sap the legs a bit, you know, you never know whether it might have a more of a softening up effect later on. But I just think that the peloton's so strong, so organized, there's so many riders that finish Milan-San Remo within touching distance of the front of the race, it's going to be very, very hard, because the Turchino, it isn't just about the distance from the finish, it's about the type of roads between that and the Tre Capi, really. It's down to the coast and then onto the coast road, and I mean, even I can ride quite fast on the coast road. It's not a difficult road to whip along, and so it would be a smart strategy to make it as hard as possible in the places where it could make a bit of a difference later on. But I don't think we're going to see, you know, the peloton shattering into pieces on the Turchino and staying shattered. I think it would all come back together again because of the nature of the roads that follow it. But certainly, you know, Pogacar has tried the Poggio moves, tried the Cipressa move. The logical thing is to try from a bit further back, and there isn't really anywhere. I mean, the Tre Capi.
Unless, Lionel, you try to sort of engineer a situation where he can literally go as the peloton turns right onto the Cipressa. They haven't managed to do that yet. Mm. They've always, you know, they've needed a bit of time for the lead out. How realistic that is? Can you already stretch the peloton out as it's going into that corner? That's a question. I mean, another obvious, again, theoretical possibility. You talked about Del Toro. If he was to go away with Del Toro and they had two cars, if it was the same configuration as last year, Ganna, Van der Poel, Del Toro and Pogacar, obviously then they could alternate in attacks, and that maybe has got potential. Another thing they've never tried, Rob, you'll know this because you often have to commentate all day, or a lot of the day, Milan-San Remo. They've never managed, or they've never tried, I don't think, this is not really the way that you tend to ride, they've never got anyone in a break. And we have seen breaks survive a long time in Milan-San Remo. If they could get someone in a break, because this is also a bit of a Bermuda Triangle between the Cipressa and the Poggio. If he was to get away on the Cipressa, well, then what happens on the other side in on the flat road between the Cipressa and the Poggio? If he had a teammate there, a satellite rider, that would be fantastic. But again, that's fantaciclismo.
It's great, though, isn't it?
Novak fantaciclismo. In the early break, then. And hope that he's still got legs between the Cipressa and the Poggio and can do a few turns. Yeah, I think it will take some kind of thinking out of the box, though, won't it? Because I think the danger is that if it's a sort of 2 or 3 or 4 man sprint at the finish, the likelihood is that Van der Poel will be there and he will be very difficult to beat no matter what. You know, the laying off didn't work last year, so what's the alternative if it comes down to the sprint? There isn't really one. So it will be really interesting to see what UAE Team Emirates try to do early on. Maybe it's that, you know, rather than take the view of going further out, maybe they put somebody else, Del Toro, make him the rider to make the first move on the Cipressa rather than Pogacar, and let everyone else be drawn out by that. Would Van der Poel and the other sort of riders who've got their eyes on the prize, would they react as strongly to a Del Toro move, or would they see that this is some kind of decoy? And then it comes down to whether UAE Team Emirates want a victory or whether they want a victory for Pogacar. And so there's so many dynamics at play in that last, what, 40-50k on Saturday. It's going to be fascinating to watch.
Think about how Quickstep used to win a lot of the classics because they had different options and they had different riders, and it sort of helped their bigger leaders when you had a, let's say, a Terpstra or a sort of very good second tier, top tier, and they end up winning Monument. Sten de Volder ended up winning the Tour of Flanders twice, didn't he? Because he was sort of was in a team with bigger leaders, managed to get out there, and it might happen, might benefit both Del Toro and Pogacar. A difficult thing to do, to attack on those sorts of gradients and attack like that and get away when there's still a whole peloton racing after you. But again, you have to try. One thing I will say, we are what, just getting towards halfway through the week now, so usual caveats of, you know, having a Michael Fish and John Ketley and getting it completely wrong. But the weather forecast, the long-range weather forecast initially is for rain, but it's also for tailwind, a very strong one, 20-plus kilometres per hour on Cipressa and Poggio, and crucially, and that section between Cipressa and Poggio.
You're looking at a different. You've been looking at a different weather forecast from
yeah,
me.
Yeah, you sure you got Saturday?
Yeah,
I've got gentle breeze and sort of sun and cloud.
Well, they're the usual caveats apply. I looked at it 36 hours ago. So there you go. It's probably changed, unfortunately.
Poggercast. One. Well, we need to mention some other riders, but before we do, one gentleman. Well, we certainly don't know what Tadej Pogacar is plotting, but one gentleman who I thought might. Is the gentleman behind whose Vespa Pogacar has been training of late on the Cipressa and the Poggio. That gentleman is a former rider. You'll probably know the name, remember the name. Nicolò Bonifazio, an Italian rider who lives and grew up near Imperia on the Milan-San Remo course. He had a chance meeting with Pogacar a few years ago. They became friends. Bonifazio retired a couple of years ago, but one of his current sidelines, he's also training to do triathlons, one of his current sidelines is as Pogacar's sort of private Milan-San Remo guru coach. I spoke to him yesterday to see if he could reveal anything or indeed knew anything about what Pogacar is planning at the weekend. I first met Tadej at the Tour of Croatia in 2018. He must have still been a junior or under 23. I won the first stage, but all anyone was talking about was this kid who they said could really climb. Well, years later, he went and proved them all right, didn't he? The way we started working together was pretty random, honestly. Last February, I hadn't touched my bike in almost a year. I'd been out maybe 3 times in 12 months. I headed out on the Via Aurelia, thinking I'd ride the Cipressa and the Poggio. He came past me on the road, and I jumped on his wheel. He laughed, I laughed. We were riding towards the Cipressa together, and half joking, he asked me to show him the best lines on the descent. I said I would, as long as he didn't drop me on the climb. This year we've gone back over the same sections with me on a motorbike, the same lines, the same corners, always looking for the extra detail. We've done the finale together maybe 3 times in total, including the other week when he broke the record on the Cipressa. It makes sense that he'd ask me. I live in Diano Marina, just down the road. I dedicated pretty much my whole career to this race. What makes Milan-San Remo so difficult is that it's an ambiguous race, shall we say, a black hole. So many have tried, so many have failed, me included. Even Cipollini, one of the greatest sprinters who ever lived, needed 11 or 12 attempts before he finally won it. That tells you everything you need to know about this race. The other thing people forget is that it's not just about the climbs. Since riders started attacking hard on the Cipressa, the descent matters more than ever. It used to be the whole peloton coming down together. Now it's 2, 3, 4 riders at most. Knowing every line, every corner, that's where the race can be won or lost. That's why Tadej called me, and frankly, others should be doing the same, because he is leaving absolutely nothing to chance. As for what he's planning on Saturday, I swear he hasn't told me a thing. I know nothing. If I were him, I wouldn't be thinking about dropping everyone on the Cipressa. This isn't the Tour of Flanders, where you just put your head down and ride away. Here, the first one to make a mistake loses. Look at Van der Poel last year. He may have suffered on the Cipressa to stay on Pogacar's wheel, but in the finale came back and attacked him right in his face, just to show he wasn't struggling. That's the kind of race this is. It's chess, not just legs. Again, the guy who wins is the guy who doesn't make mistakes. I'll be in San Remo on Saturday. I'll have lunch first, then head out to watch the finale by the finish line. My prediction? You guessed it. He who makes no mistakes will be the winner.
Well, chaps, you heard it there. Even Nicolò Bonifazio, local boy, even for him, Milan San Remo is, as he said, a black box. Impossible to read, impossible to know what is going to happen.
Just before we move on from UAE Team Emirates, they also have Florian Vermeersch in the team, a very strong classics rider. He's got a big night tonight because, Daniel, you mentioned a couple of weeks ago, he's a Newcastle United supporter, so he'll be glued to Newcastle United's Champions League game against Barcelona, I imagine. Apparently, a week ago, he was on Belgian television at well past 11 o'clock at night talking about Newcastle's Champions League game, the first leg against Barcelona, the night before a recon ride on the Paris-Roubaix cobbles.
I wonder what was coming next. I thought you were going to say way past his bedtime then.
Way past his bedtime with a big day of riding the following day. I've tried to find out why he supports Newcastle.
He didn't reveal it to us. No. He's also a big admirer of Winston Churchill, so maybe there'll be a rousing, we will fight them on the Ligurian beaches, we will fight them on the Turquino speech in the bus.
He did go to a recent Newcastle versus Manchester City game, so, you know, a bona fide Geordie. We should move on and talk about some other riders.
We should. Quickly, chaps, we should... Well, let's have a little bit of a... let's throw some other names into the ring. I mean, I think it's been a good couple of weeks for Visma. Lisa Boat mentioned a couple of their riders earlier. Van Aert is maybe back, restored to health, restored to form a bit earlier than people expected. He was looking quite good in Tirreno. There is this question mark, there is this worry about whether he is as confident in the bunch as he was maybe a couple of years ago after all of his crashes. So he is certainly someone with a chance, I would suggest. Matthew Brennan is making his debut in the race. A lot of people are looking at him, although another question mark about the extent to which any sprinter, and Brennan's maybe not a pure sprinter, but any sprinter will be able to survive the heat that Pogacar and Van der Poel put on everyone else on the Cipressa and the Poggio. Other names that stand up: Pidcock. I think he'll do well in Milan Torino today, but he should be sniffing around certainly on Cipressa and Poggio as well. Other names, chaps?
Pidcock's a good shout given the descending that's to be done as well, and it seems to be that sort of scary to commentate on sometimes as well, that people keep pushing it more and more and more to the limit. I was talking about that with Sean last week, and we were both sort of saying that we enjoyed watching it, but also worried that one day someone will push it a little too far. But of course he has the skills, doesn't he, like we saw Mohoric a few years ago down that downhill. Has to be there in the right situation of the race, and I'm looking on the start list. For me, I find it really hard to look past Alpecin Premier Tech with their lineup, and the way we saw an opening weekend as well, the way that they live for the classics, don't they, and the way they just switch it on for opening weekend is exceptional. If you want to look at a team that's going well at the minute and a rider who could be there or thereabouts, Filippo Ganna and Ineos Grenadiers.
Alpecin Premier Tech, I get what you're saying, Rob, but Jasper Philipsen is not as hot as he was the year he won it. So will he be as effective a decoy for Van der Poel? I think as well, will, you know, if the heat on the Cipressa is as hot as it was last year, and perhaps even hotter, I think that the sprinters, the pure sprinters, will be distanced there. And even if it comes back together, it might be one of those years where we see a sort of a funny win, a Jasper Stuyven type win, because it's been such a hard race in that phase that when it comes back together, it's not just about who the fastest of the sprinters are, it's about who's got the strongest legs remaining.
Tobias Lund, someone like that?
Good shout. Looking good, isn't he?
Yeah, I've got a hunch that at some point this year, Jonas Abrahamsen is going to do a madness in a big race.
That would be good, wouldn't it?
If he is in the early break, then that will make me sort of sit up a little bit straighter, I would suggest. But it takes a bit of a... It will need a bit of a sort of crazy horse, won't it, to thwart Pogacar and Van der Poel. I mean, a few weeks ago I said about Van der Poel, the biggest problem that Pogacar has is that Van der Poel seems to, he sort of flies through the spring on this kind of magic carpet where, because he's such a good bike handler and because he's so strong, he manages to avoid crashes, he manages to avoid illnesses, and that has been, you could sort of say that Pogacar has all, well, 50% of Pogacar's hopes have already gone by virtue of the fact that Van der Poel is probably going to be on the start line healthy in form. The odds, Pogacar's odds have already lengthened because of that.
I think the makeup of the early break will tell us a lot about what to expect later on, won't it? If a big team or two manages to get somebody in the early break, that would completely change the complexion of the race. My suspicion is that it will be a four-man break, somebody from Bardiani, somebody from Unibet Rose Rocket, somebody from Pulte Visit Malta, and somebody from Novo Nordisk. But maybe I'm being, a little bit uncharitable there. There's somebody might try and put a really strong rider or two in a break, but it's not in anybody else's interest, is it, to allow that break to go beyond sort of 7-8 riders. I mean, we haven't seen that for a long time. It will be about containing the numbers in that early break and also ensuring that there isn't somebody that might pull off something surprising later on. So it could be quite a scrap from the start just to try and make sure that that break isn't too unpredictable. I know Rob, who's on commentary duty from flag to finish, are you? You'll be hoping for a lively start.
Oh, that will make my day. A nice fast first hour. That'd be wonderful.
Yeah, we've talked a lot, haven't we, about this being a key facet of Pogacar and UAE's strategy over the last couple of years, and maybe the reason why he's winning races even more emphatically, more convincingly than even he was 3 or 4 years ago. And it has been the fast starts, the sort of 50, 55 kilometre an hour first hours. And we've not really seen that in Milan-San Remo, unless I'm mistaken, Rob, but I don't think we've really seen that. Whether you can do it in a 290-kilometre race, that's the big difference with Milan-San Remo. It's a pretty daunting distance. It's one thing doing it when you know that you're going to unleash Pogacar after 120 kilometres of racing, but when you're going to unleash him after 265, then that becomes very daunting for the other teammates. Anyway, chaps, is that about enough for Milan-San Remo? Lionel, we'll be back on Saturday for the first Arrivé of the season. The women's race is also happening on Saturday. Is an Arrivé for that, Lionel?
There is indeed, yeah. We will be online on Saturday evening. It will be our sort of first reaction to what we've just watched, won't it, Daniel? I always quite enjoy the opportunity to just kind of say exactly what we've seen and try and unpick it before, you know, the whole world of takes has had their go at the cake. But what's interesting, given last week's heated debate about whether Pogacar's dominance of certain races is becoming boring, is that this is anything but, isn't it? For the very reasons we talked about last week in our hopefully not too binary discussion, hopefully it was a little bit more nuanced. Certainly we've had a lot of feedback from listeners. Daniel, we're almost at the position where we need Team Lionel, Team Daniel and Team Brian t-shirts. Obviously, as a champion of mediocrity, my Team Lionel t-shirt would be a fetching shade of beige. But I'll put some of the feedback we've had in the next edition of the 1101 Cappuccino. I think somebody put it best. Michael Holden said, I'm not going to say if I find it boring, exciting or somewhere in between, because quite simply there's no right or wrong answer. It's how we feel, then that's how we feel. What I will say is I thoroughly enjoyed the chat. So, well, thank you, Michael. I think we quite enjoyed having the chat, didn't we?
We did. Relatively civil conversation, wasn't it? I think.
quite rare these days.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm sure Saturday will be exciting. I personally am looking forward to Jan Christen dropping everyone, including his team leader, and winning and arriving resplendent in a mankini on Via Roma around 5 o'clock on Saturday.
If there's anyone going to attack on the Turchino, it's Jan Christen.
Or probably riding a mankini.
Just before we go, a quick stop press to update on the two major men's races that took place today after we'd recorded on the Wednesday before Milan-San Remo, because there are two results that may well have a bearing on Saturday's race. First of all, Milano-Torino was won by Tom Pidcock on the Superga climb ahead of Tobias Holland Johannessen of Uno X Mobility. He had a very good week at Tirreno Adriatico. And then came two Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe riders, Primoz Roglic taking the third place and the final step on the podium ahead of his young teammate Giulio Pellizzari. Meanwhile, up in Belgium at Nokere Corsa, Jasper Philipsen, remember last year he crashed in Nokere Corsa, which kind of derailed his defence of his Milan-San Remo crown. I said earlier in the episode that he'd had a bit of an underwhelming season so far. Well, he got his first race win of 2026 today for Alpecin Premier Tech, winning Nocera Corsa ahead of Jordi Meus and Juan Sebastian Milano. So both Philipson and Pidcock in good form ahead of the opening monument of the season on Saturday.
Right, chaps, that's enough, I think. Thank you for your attention, and we will be back on Saturday.
Thank you, Rob.
Ciao.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.